Hello, Alpaca Pushers listeners. I am Ethan Banks, bringing you the final show in our series of podcasts recorded at Cisco Live 2012 in San Diego, California. And this one was maybe the most fun of the bunch. We invited anyone from the Twitterverse who was interested in taking part in a live show to come to the Cisco Live social media lounge. When everyone showed up, we passed the microphone around. We recorded with the No Strings Attached Show, a wireless networking podcast that you should definitely go check out at nostringsattachedshow.com. Blake Crony runs that podcast and hosted this show with me. I open up the show with a question to the audience to get things started.
So let's start out with impressions of some of the announcements Cisco made. We can start with 1PK. There was other stuff announced too, like the cloud services router. Anything you want to chat about? Colin, you raised your hand first, so if you're ready, you can talk about some of that.
My name is Colin McNamara, blog at ColinMcNamara.com, Twitter at Colin McNamara, director of the data center practice at Nexus IS Inc. of our out here. So with the OpenFlow announcements, one thing that's really interesting to me is a lot of the discussion that's been OpenFlow has been frankly academic. It has been a bunch of guys in colleges who don't actually have to manage production networks. You know, they got college kids. And the OpenFlow discussion in the past has been all about taking cheap silicon, cheap things, putting a smart server about it and having that server go and push this intelligence through, you know, hundreds of devices, thousands of devices. What was most interesting to me was Cisco's take on it. And we'll see if it's right or wrong, right? But how they're saying, how they want to approach the SDN side is not by dumbing things down, but by easing the consumption for the programmers. Something where, you know, I think it's not as well addressed in the SDN market right now. You know, they're talking to computer science majors. What happens when your customer needs to do something with this network? I think that Cisco may be going down the right direction of making an easily addressable, easily used API to manage not a whole replacement of the network, but the investments they already have.
So Mr. Tom Hollingsworth is going to grab the mic here.
Hi, it's Tom, the networking nerd. Blog at networkingnerd.net, snarky Twitter at networkingnerd. I agree with Colin. I mean, I think that in a way Cisco had to announce SDN. If anybody follows Tony Burke on Twitter, you notice he said something kind of snarky. Is Cisco really committed to SDN, or are they just putting it on a slide to shut up the analysts? I think that they are committed. I do. But I think what I'm waiting to see, you know, because for those of you who read my blog, you notice that I don't say anything about SDN because for the longest time, I really didn't understand what I was listening to. I mean, Greg and Ethan have been kind of on the forefront of this, and I've been trying to play catch up, and I finally got it out here at Cisco Live. I finally found a use case that works for me for, you know, rethinking network monitoring. And I'm looking at this from the perspective of, you know, even going so far as saying maybe we could have something like a network app store for our customers because, you know, think about development for Apple iOS. I can do lots of really cool things with my phone and not need to know how to program. But if I know how to program, I can do even more cool things. So the APIs that were announced, the ability to hook into different places in the network, I don't have to be constrained by all the previous constructs. I can finally jettison SNMP and burn that ship to the ground. And that kind of makes me happy.
I want to add another question to this, Blake Crony from the NSA show. I want to know, what is your guys' take on these APIs? How many of you guys are, in any shape or form, a programmer? What programming language do you use? What would you want to use? Or if you were given the option to have some kind of community with training information, if you were to be able to start doing some scripts or something, is that something that you would be interested in trying to learn how to do if there was a Perl or a Ruby or some type of scripting language to at least get you started for proof of concepts?
My name is Justin. My handle on Twitter is at Grinthok. I apologize for the voice. It's been a long couple days. I take offense to Tom's comment, though, about SNMP. I happen to like SNMP very much. So we're going to...
I'm the SNMP hater.
You are the SNMP hater. You know, I'm not a programmer. Like, I don't know how many people here are programmers. I can read other people's code. That's about as far as I go. But scripting is where I do a lot of work. I do a lot of work in orchestration, automation, around various types of scripting, one being PowerShell. And I know a lot of people aren't Microsoft fans here, but in the Microsoft world, there's a lot of orchestration and a lot of automation being done with PowerShell. So Cisco bringing out things like complete PowerShell support for UCS, complete PowerShell support from storage vendors, and some of the other products. I think that is somewhere where there's a lot of activity and a lot of things that people like us that are not totally programmers, but geeks enough to script, we can really bring some value to the table.
Name's Daryl Clute. I'm a network engineer at Daryl Clute on Twitter. So I've done a lot of automation using SNMP read-write streams and scripting around that. And the fact that they're going to have a unified API across all platforms eventually means that instead of having to work with unique MIBs on individual devices, I can now script everything for any device from one place, and it's using the same API calls. And as far as languages, I personally prefer Python for programming. But I mean, Cisco's also put a lot of money into Puppet, which is based on Ruby. So we're going to see a lot of interesting integrations there as well in the future.
Cisco's made it pretty clear in a lot of the sessions I'm in that they're going really towards this XML API thing on a lot of their stuff. Especially if you look at from the UCS, they're saying, look, here's an XML API. People can write whatever they want for it. And I know they're doing the same thing on some of the other products as well. So I think if they go down the path of the XML API, it's probably best because, you know, you want to use Ruby, go for it. You want to use PowerShell, go for it. It doesn't really matter because I think that's probably the best API to use. It's significantly more friendly to the rest of the scripters and programmers.
Colin McNamara again. So, one thing that's interesting, talk about API. So people look at this as in, is Cisco trying to compete in the SDN space? But I've used the XML APIs in a call manager for years. When 3.3 went to 4.1, had to go from double line to single line, you're migrating 30, 40,000 phones. You have to use those APIs, And over the years, we've used Axle toolkits, used Perl, used Expect, used Python. What I like and what I hope to see is, and I'm really excited with One Unified SDK, is one place where Cisco's posting libraries, code examples. For me, I go through my code folder and just folders and folders and folders, different languages, different APIs, different examples. Being able to simplify that for myself allows me to reuse a lot of the different intellectual property I've created over the years. I'm hoping our customers do too.
So here's, Colin, you just alluded to, I think, what is a really good point. In order for this API flavor of SDN, if you will, to take off, where it's going to be customer driven as opposed to Cisco or some other vendor really laying on a whole tool set on top of it that you don't even know the APIs or what's being used, but you've got this magical console that's allowing you to configure the network. If they're going to leave it to us as the customers to actually leverage these APIs to do some different things we've never done with networking before, there needs to be a community built around those APIs. Now, I've raised an example in the past of F5 Networks as Dev Central. Absolutely. So who's got a comment on that and what they'd like to see in a community?
This is Jennifer Huber and Jennifer Lucille at Twitter and Jennifer Huber at Blogspot. I was just going to say the same thing. I think that we definitely need to develop our own community, something along the lines of the THWAC with SolarWinds, yep, or how Spice works, where the whole community comes together to share tips and tricks how to do, even if you don't want to give away like really great IP, even just like basic stuff or how to monitor. Because I'm not a programmer or a scripter. I've tried Perl, but I didn't have the timeline to learn it. So I would definitely need people to contribute even basic modules that I can plug and play, because along with anything like Ubuntu or Linux, I have no idea what I'm doing. I need to trust others that have done it before and could help.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So,
The community aspect would give us all an opportunity to get started, look at code that other people have written, and then tweak it for our own environments. And then once you kind of get the idea of what's going, you could really run with it.
Yeah.
Who else has actually been in that model?
Hi, this is Ben Story. I'm at NTWRK80 on the Twitter and showbrain.blogspot.com for blogging. What Jennifer was talking about with the community is Cisco has tried this in the past. The EEM scripts were a complete failure in terms of community-based bringing it together. No one wanted to give up their great scripts, and I think part of it is because it was Cisco-driven. People said, well, we spend all this money on Cisco gear. Why should I give up my stuff to a large corporation to then give it out for free to somebody else? And I think that, it may be that we as community packet pushers and such, we need to be the repository instead of the big bad Cisco that somebody's afraid is going to steal your IP.
And sell it.
Yeah, and sell it.
My name is Kellen Christensen, at KDC824 on Twitter, systems administrator for a manufacturing group in Oregon. Justin brought up a great point earlier when he brought up PowerShell. There are so many PowerShell resources out there. There's a TechNet managed community that Microsoft has. Almost all of the individual product lines, Link, Exchange, etc., all have their own blogs with their own set of PowerShell scripts. And between that and TechNet's enormously dense PowerShell guides that they have on their website that tell you every command, every switch, all the different things you can do with it. If you've got a really strong, essentially a dictionary on how to use those individual commands that get developed through a scripting language like that, it's easy to Frankenstein together something. You know, take a little bit off this blog you saw, go back, look at the switches, change the switches you need. All of a sudden, you're building your own scripts based on, you know, a little bit of somebody else's work, some basic research. Microsoft really hit the nail on the head. We've done a lot of work within PowerShell within our organization. We're a heavy Microsoft shop. And we've got, you know, new user scripts that are one long script that builds their Link, their Exchange, their AD account, puts them into file server groups to the point that we don't have to do anything. A process that would have taken our desktop group, you know, 30 minutes to set up a user, we can now do in about 5. If Cisco can get a community, give them the framework to be able to go out and build their own and then backfeed it into a group much like TechNet, it's an easy win for them. They've put very little effort into it but had a tremendous amount of result.
So what do you think of what would help you? Were you looking for something in addition to along the blogs and everything like what you get from the MSDN, the TechNet? So are you also looking for an SDK that is more of a GUI-based SDK where you could plug in little blocks? Would that be something that would be beneficial, do you think?
You know, I think it would work in some circumstances. We also, one of the other products, we have the Symantec management platform, and their workflows are also doing much the same thing in that GUI-based blocks, easy to administer, easy to deploy whatever changes you need within your MS environment. They could go either way. I know a lot of Microsoft admins that absolutely love their GUI, and I know a lot of Microsoft admins that would rather do all of their work in PowerShell and never see a desktop. So I think at that point it becomes an option. Let the user community figure out what they want to do best.
Tony Mankey with the hoarse voice.
Yeah, you may not be able to hear me very well, but some of the concerns I have regarding this are, you know, we start importing these scripts from any various source on the internet. We're talking about, you know, enterprise level service provider networks, large networks that are very sensitive to data flows. We're going to have to really keep an eye on where we're importing these from. We're going to have to test these scripts in our lab. I haven't really seen, none of us have really seen the programming language around this. We don't know what kind of level it's going to be. Is it going to be ANSIC or is it going to be, you know, Ruby?
Today it's C and Java. That's all that's been done so far is C and Java. And Cisco's open to suggestion about where to take it next.
Yeah. So, I mean, if we have a higher level scripting language, we'll be able to see a little bit more of what's going on in these user examples. But it'd be so easy for someone to obfuscate their code to the point where you're black holing flows and not knowing it.
Yeah, and I think the big thing is that it's a compiled versus non-compiled code. We need to have non-compiled code. If it has to be compiled, we need to do that ourselves so that we can look at that source code and we can figure out, okay, this is what this is exactly doing. There's no phoning home. Somebody's not rerouting anything that they shouldn't.
Community actually gets us in that direction. We're going to vet. The nature of putting source code out in the community means the code is implicitly vetted.
But you do that now, right? You run stuff on your network that's compiled code and you're trusting the vendor is not doing something bad with it.
Right.
You know, of course we trust the vendor. Yeah.
Well, I mean, not us. I mean, no, apparently not everyone trusts us, but I mean, other third-party stuff, right? I mean, network management tool, a polling tool, traffic analysis, you have compiled an executable that you're running and you're hoping, okay, hopefully this guy's not screwing me in the process.
Yeah.
So just a couple of things. This is a great conversation. I really appreciate it. I'm going to make sure we, you know, distribute this widely internally. A couple of things. In terms of the community, our intent is for a community to happen. I mean, you know, a lot of times that when we're pushing this internally, I talk about, you know, something like GitHub. We have an opportunity, you come up with something cool, and you don't have to share all your IP, but some cool idea, post it and start propagating things like that. It'll either come up organically, or we may have to host it, or we may have to give a kickstart or something. What we're looking for is for the community, you know, so at the end of the day, we want a community to happen. How it gets there is how it gets there. But I agree. You see that as very much a key part of this strategy. The second piece from the programmatic perspective, I'm not sure how many of you folks caught this, but these are the same APIs and tools our folks are using. So the same APIs that we unload, you know, we expose, we're handing out, the same stuff our folks are using. So in terms of tools, development, those kinds of things, you know, understand we're going to stick past it. So, I mean, stick to it. In terms of languages, you know, we started with C and Java. At the end of the long-term strategy is wherever your developers are is where we want to meet them. So we're going to say, we're not going to say, hey, we can open up all these APIs, but you need to learn one of these two things, and that's it. The goal is to open up as widely as we can. It's going to take time. The way these conversations are helpful and continue to send feedback is to try and sequence, and some of you have heard this before, try and sequence, okay, we give you number one and number two that are like, help us figure out number three, four, and five are like.
Yeah.
That's, you know, that's really how we look at this thing unfolding.
And Omar, I think we've been talking to Omar Sultan. You are the Senior Director for Emerging Technologies?
I wish. I'm only the Senior Manager for Emerging Technologies.
Senior Manager, okay.
I was going to have a much nicer suit, but okay.
A question comes up here in that a lot of the guys that are sitting around the room here, we are network engineers. We work on the nuts and bolts of the network. We're not developers as such.
Sure.
On the other side, you might have developers and corporations that would be leveraging these APIs. So there's really two different audiences these APIs are targeted at, maybe more than that.
Many more, yeah.
Yeah. So, in our minds, we're looking at C and Java and going, that's not us. We really want something else. I mean, mm-hmm. Is Cisco hearing that message?
Absolutely. I mean, the plan, again, there's only so much we can roll out at one time. Start with C and Java, and a lot of it is because, certainly, that's what, you know, literally, the Cloud Connector stuff you heard about on Tuesday,
yeah. That's,
you know, these same APIs are what we use to implement those kinds of things. So, absolutely, longer term, we view this as a horizontal play. Right. This is horizontal functionality. It's going to be very broad based across the market. So it's going to take a number of different. There's not one size fits all in terms of languages or approach or delivery or support or community. And we see that as being how things are evolving. But at the same time, it's going to take some time. Right. We can only turn up a language or two at a time. And it's not so much, hey, here's an interface, here's Java support, here's Python support.
Yeah.
We also want to make sure there's a decent developer experience wrapped around that. So it's not like, here's support, and there's no resources anywhere to be found to actually help you with that. There's no code libraries, there's no sample scripts. So
meaning it's going to take time to develop the infrastructure around whatever the next piece is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there's got to be documentation, there's got to be examples, so it's not just, okay, here it is, and no.
Yeah.
There's nothing else beyond it. So part of it is to make sure you have a good experience, because the last thing we need is someone to say, oh, you know, their Python support sucks because there's nothing out there.
Yeah.
It doesn't, it doesn't help anyone's cause. Yeah. So, my two pieces are, patience, understand what our end game is, but also, lots of feedback to help us figure out what resources are helpful, what is important, really looking for some help with the directionality of this.
There were a lot of other announcements that were made. One of them, cloud services router. It wasn't mentioned in much detail. Did you guys catch that? The cloud services router, what that is? Is anybody interested in talking about that or not really? Cloud services router is, what was it, iOS XE? Trying to remember. Yeah, it was iOS XE. Put in a VM and stuck up like any other host you'd have up in the... up on a VMware box, for example. It's a full-blown router that runs as a host in your VMware environment. And you can present as many NICs to it, VNICs to it as you want, and push traffic into and out of it. The play being public cloud. If you're hosting services up on Amazon, let's say, and you want to terminate a bunch of services like tunnels, encrypted tunnels, and treat your public cloud presence just like any other remote office, the cloud services router that Cisco's doing here is intending to give you that ability. So,
Colin's got an opinion.
I'd say more than opinion, a use case. So, I mean, Viata, you know, was very forward thinking. They took, you know, Zebra, some open source products, and they made a virtual router. But at the end of the day, you know, anyone can make a router. You know, Cisco's in a space where a lot of people do what it tries to do what Cisco does. Cisco does it better. For me myself, literally, this is going to lower my cost in my labs. So on demand engineering. So internally to be able to provide virtual machines, virtual connectivity, on demand via VCDX training internally for my own employees. One of the big problems is when you spin up a virtual data center, being able to route in and out of it, being able to do the proper NAT translations, being able to get around having a jump host. You know, you think cloud when you see cloud services router, but all of us have DR sites. You might have to spin up a small site, and maybe even a remote office up really quick. You know, there's a lot of things that you can do with this product that very much is a little out of the box thinking. But I feel what we see here is really where we see all of Cisco's networking platforms moving to, because you know the power's in the software, the power's in integration, the power's not that it fits in a 19-inch box anymore. Power's in the features it gives you.
My question is, what products do you think it'll displace or replace?
It's not a displacement technology at this point, I don't think. I mean, it's really kind of a new thing. We haven't had an abstracted iOS that can ride in a VM before. Okay.
We all have.
Legal. Yeah. Let's rephrase it. A legal way of doing it. So let me give you one use case for the cloud services router, which we talked about during a show. So there's another show we recorded earlier. You can take a cloud services router and put it in, say, instantiate over in an Amazon cloud, run up a bunch of servers in the back there, and then you can use the CSR to run a DMVPN tunnel back to your data center, and then you can use Lisp to then divert a workload from your live data center to an Amazon cloud. Now think about that for a minute. Let's say that you've got two data centers of your own, and then you've decided that you want to outsource some stuff to Amazon in Dublin, and then you've also got one on the west coast of the USA. So now you've just made yourself four data centers. You can use Lisp to migrate those loads around dynamically, and you can use DMVPN to encrypt the sessions between point to point over the internet to get access to those data centers. And there's some really interesting dynamics around that in terms of how you start to change your data. Imagine shutting down a data center, migrating all you've got to upgrade your data center, so you shut it all down, migrate your loads to the other side, do whatever you need to do in your data center, using Amazon for a day or two while you're out there, then bringing all your loads back in. No impact to the customer. Wow. A few risks there around using the cloud and whether you get that right, but there's a way of actually shutting down a data center, doing an upgrade, and then bringing all your workloads back. So yeah, some really interesting ideas around that if you take the time to think about that. It's worth having another scratch at the cloud services router for some, you know, cloud bursting ideas. Oh, I just said cloud.
I kind of felt like it was the most understated announcement of the show, because it's one of those things where you can wrap your brain around it real quick and then go, that's cool. I can do a whole bunch of things with it. And I didn't feel like it got a lot of press. Anyway.
One of those things that it's like as time goes on, you're going to go, oh, I could use that here. Oh, I could use it there. You know, it's one of those things that's like we haven't had that tool before. So now that we have that tool, it's the kind of thing that's like as you go to solve the next problem, you go, I have a new tool in my toolbox. That is a great solution for that.
It's a solution looking for a problem almost. Yeah. But now that we have
but
it,
but there in are our, actual problems oh, that this are. Can solve.
But now we have this. Now when we're thinking about solutions for problems that we're having or things we want to do, we can go, oh, that now we have that we can use. So
yeah,
I think it's going to take a couple months to sort of come up with the use cases to show it.
Yeah. Well, you really want to blow your mind. Think about the futures. You know, you got the 1000V working on any other hypervisor. You got all these virtual appliances, virtual routers, virtual firewalls that can use VPath to basically take data going through them through a choke point. And then once they say it should be going in a direction, utilize the hypervisor to move it inside of the virtualization layer. Or, you know, you kind of look at the potential of the technology to even shoot it out. You know, where by having this router in that virtual layer, what other things that we're not doing right now, you know, what other possibilities are there? It's really, really kind of blows your mind when you think about it.
Yeah. Marco, introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Marco. Listeners probably have heard my voice before. And One of the things that immediately comes to mind, and me being with the service provider and MPLS background, is that from this router we could run a tunnel over to another virtual router someplace else over an IP network that doesn't have to be flat anymore. It can be a hierarchical, nicely built layer 3 network running the services. Then we build a tunnel to another place, and then we can have end-to-end layer 2, which is required by most of the virtual most of the virtualization services these days. So I think that there is a great benefit of it from having it, but do we really need to have a virtual router would be my question. I'm going to go back to what I said a couple of months ago in Cisco, and that is we need to fix the applications, not try to work around them.
Yeah, so Christopher Church, layer_3 on Twitter. So the thing that struck me about the cloud services router was the fact that you're bringing the MPLS PE all the way down into the hypervisor and terminating it there. You know, I'm watching this and I'm thinking about, okay, all this extra complexity now that we're putting in there, and now the security ramifications of that as well, you know, and then all the different building blocks that they had there on the screen, the cloud services piece, the N1000V, you know, the vShield piece, you know, that type of thing. So
you are, in fact, removing the complexity by having this, because we needed to have a complex solution for a relatively simple problem now. Now we are just moving this into the virtualization layer, and we are saying, okay, so now we are going to do it in the box, but our network can remain simple, and simple usually means stable. What you want to do is remove the complexity from the network and put it to the edge. This is how it has been working for many, many years successfully.
No, I just had, when you're talking about moving the MPLS provider edge down in the virtualization layer, I think some challenges I faced about a year ago, it was a 250,000 square foot data center, 7K, 5K, 2K, and we actually had to shrink the domains of the pods, right, the 7K, 5K, 2K pods because of MAC addresses, right? And it doesn't matter what provider, what hardware provider you have, you're running into that constraint in a highly virtualized environment. By having things like the CSR in the virtualization layer and utilizing MPLS to create tunnels between these, remember, our northbound networking equipment now does not have to be aware of all those MAC addresses. It might actually create a lot of flexibility in some of the classic network designs northbound of these layers.
All right, so we're taking the mic back to Mr. Omar Sultan.
So it's Omar again. So I'd argue two months later, you know, what 1PK does is the opportunity to fix the applications, right? Because it changed, at least it gives developers the tools to have the applications be much more infrastructure friendly. Whether they take advantage of that is a whole different conversation. But, you know, our longer term vision, and this is vision, this is my disclaimer, is to really get to the point where a developer can ask for a service. I need the access to the nearest firewall. I need a 10 gig link that's video capable or, you know, is vMotion capable. Pass that request to the network and let the network figure out what's the best, most efficient, most non-stupid way to make that happen. So I think we're starting to get more of the pieces on the table to make that happen. You know, part of it, and this is part of the bigger developer push, is to drive traction and have developers not be scared of this stuff and think, oh, networking's a pain in the ass. I might rather just, you know, treat it as a black hole. I'll just shove data through and let someone else figure it out. I think the other thing I'll tease a little bit is we're not done yet with these cloud announcements, right? If you look at what we talked about in the keynote at VMworld last year, you know, we see this physical to virtual to cloud continuum being built, you know, this evolution. And our goal in life, you kind of see what we've delivered, is to give you a consistent experience regardless of where a workload happens to sit. My goal in life is you should not care where your workload sits. Today, where it is tomorrow. You know, network policy, security policy, all that stuff should continue to work. And you'll see the cloud services router is another piece of that. You get consistent routing capabilities, much like any of our other routers. It just happens to be running in a virtualized instance. Now, we're not all not said and done, but at the end of the day, that's kind of the end run. And it's kind of funny because, you know, we get beat on for being a hardware company. But a lot we're doing is taking a lot of our stuff and throwing the hardware away. And going back to the point, I mean, there was a time when, 20 years ago, I think it feels like, where we used to be very much about being a software company. We branded iOS and said a lot of our value comes from being the software, and I think it's kind of coming full circle. And we're starting to reemphasize that again.
one obvious question we should ask here, because I know people that listen to the show are going to be interested in it. All right, so now you've got a product, cloud services router, that you can put in a virtual machine and run run virtualized that way.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then, for those of us that want to build lab environments and so on, is there going to be a legitimate Cisco-sanctioned option that we'll have to run iOS virtualized that's been maybe license-restricted or something, so that we can work on iOS in our labs or if we're studying for exams and so on, and not have to do it, you know, looking over our shoulders to see if Cisco's looking at us.
I mean, is there like a lab version of CSR?
Or just iOS else? In general? I mean, Cisco's kind of proven that they can do it, so...
You know, I don't have an answer to that particular one in terms of what that's going to do in terms of changing our licensing on those things.
Okay, so it's theoretically possible. You're still not going to make a commitment that that's coming.
I'm not setting company policy on our podcast.
I think Marco's got a point he wants to make over on this one.
I'm going to invoke the ultimate trump card here. I asked this on the NetVet CCI reception. I asked this question to Mr. John Chambers, and he said, talk to the relevant executives. Back to him.
You obviously need to set a higher bar for executive. If he said, talk to the relative cog in the machine, that would be me.
For Omar, it's not fair to put him on the spot like that. It's not right.
I know there's a demand. You know, obviously, you understand we have certain challenges with that. I think we're trying to do the right thing and find a middle ground. Because there's a legitimate need, we recognize that. You know, there are folks that are looking at it.
Yeah.
So I can...
Sure. That's fair.
We're not deaf to your requirements. We're just trying to find a legitimate way of meeting your requirements, which serve us in the long run. We get that piece, too. At the same time, not completely destroying our business model in the process.
Yeah. You guys on the wrong switch side thing have it easy because you have those ways that you could look over your shoulder if you wanted to and try to run something else. Those of us studying down the wireless track... It's very hard to emulate an RF and actually be able to test that.
They're called microwaves.
Yeah. Can't you just run the oven with the door open and do the same thing?
Why don't you go sit the CCIU wireless, Tom? I think you're going to pass. You're ready for it. So I think one of the things that, you know, I'm interested in is we see all this stuff obviously coming on for the route switch, the components, the nexuses and everything. It'll be interesting to see what happens whatever the case may be, when a wireless controller switches to iOS, if that happens in the near future. I see a lot of potential uses for the SDKs and the APIs and everything through the wireless, on being able to manage your wireless connections, your clients, getting more information about them. Mm-hmm. I'd really like to see what's going to happen there, and I'm hoping that that's going to be in the near future, not in the very long future, because it's... Unfortunately, it's a hard part being that we're on airspace. We're not on iOS on our controllers.
Me too. I mean, certainly, if you've heard my spiel, you know, we see the enterprise adoption for all this stuff kind of being on the trailing edge, because it's not the killer use case for this. But I do, you know, certainly wireless, actually, I think is one of the things that could drive, you know, faster adoption. Because it does, you know, in theory, it lets you do some really cool things. Mm-hmm. From a wireless perspective, they're either A, hard to do, or... not doable at all, at least with what's out there currently.
Yeah,
I take a little bit of offense to Omar's comment about...
Should you sit in the middle?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Omar. I don't want to call you out, but you stated that 1PK and the CSR actually could solve fix the application issues. What we're really doing is putting a Band-Aid on the application issues. We're using that to fix those problems. We're adding complexity, which really goes against robustness. We can't use that as the one fix-all Band-Aid for everything, or else we're going to end up with the same problems we've been at for the past 10 years. And we're going to be solving the same issues over again in a few years.
So the issue you just raised really is, okay, 1PK, APIs, a whole new way to program the network. Did we just open up the door to a whole boatload of more bugs? It's another complex thing. Bugs have been a challenge with iOS, NXOS, et cetera, for quite a while. Is this going to be another challenge of bugs?
I don't see it in terms of complexity or the application. It's, you know, the network is this thing that is, you know, exists today but doesn't exist tomorrow. It's something that the network kind of evolves over time, and you know, maybe today the application doesn't fit the way we're doing networking. Maybe in the future the application and the network are more closer to the same thing. You know, between, you know, wireless and wired, there's a big discrepancy. But as we move forward, it would be really cool to see things like SDN and, you know, the API stuff coming together and saying, okay, this is how we do it today. This isn't how we have to do it in the future. We have, you know, end-to-end programmability. Maybe it's an overlay management piece that says, okay, you know, I have a router in the cloud. I have my airspace, you know, OS or iOS-based wireless LAN controller in the cloud. I now have the flexibility to really change the end-to-end piece of the network, instead of saying, well, I need to fix just the applications and how they...
That's the promise of it, but what about the bugginess and so on that potentially could introduce? Does that intimidate you at all?
Well, I also think as network engineers, we're going to have to change. You know, today, how many people said, well, I'm not a software developer? Well, I came from that software development background, and it's like, you know, network architects are taking the limitations of the network and putting pieces together to make it work. And maybe that's not necessarily the case moving forward. It's maybe we use these tools and pieces in different ways to solve the same set of problems. Maybe there's more complexity in some of it. Maybe it's simple. It simplifies it in the long term. But, you know, software, you know, Cisco, you know, it used to be hardware. Now it's becoming software. And 10 years from now, maybe, you know, hardware will be a long dead thing, and we'll be like, how, remember when we had to have individual boxes for routers? And, you know, but that doesn't mean that, you know, necessarily that the app tomorrow is still going to function the way the apps today work. And, you know, even at the OS level, you know, you'll start seeing network architects being software guys, and plugging pieces in is just a construction of putting hardware and software.
I think there's a lot of good points about the bugs and everything, especially considering that was one of the questions that was asked at the CCIE NetVet reception with Chambers, was what's going on with the quality at Cisco, whether it's hardware or software related. On the wireless side of things, we have certainly seen some of the releases in the latest 7.0 trains and the 6.0 trains having very critical flaws, that it's one of those, how did this make it out of QA? Now, if we open up with the 1PK APIs, we're introducing the potential for a lot more bugs. That certainly is the case, and I think that's where the community and everything is going to help out, and the training, that whether it's the community-based training or if it's Cisco-led training, is going to be an important factor, is really understanding this product. How are you actually going to be able to use this product in a safe manner that doesn't create any buffer overflows or doesn't have a resource hog, and all of a sudden you can't do any of your packet forwardings anymore?
So I think we have a better answer than we did 2 months ago. You can take a unicorn to water, you can't make it drink. So we've given developers better tools. Whether they use them or not, I certainly don't have any control. I don't think any of you have any control. I think part of the success of this is how effectively you can sit down with the folks that develop applications and advocate this. I mean, certainly we're doing it on our end. I mean, we're going out, you know, part of our effort is to go out to ISVs and your folks and help them figure out, hey, this is cool. This is going to help you write better applications. You can write an application that, you know, runs more effectively on top of the network, and it'll be a benefit for you in terms of how your ability to sell and position in the market. But at the end of the day, it's not a magic cure, but I think it's a better set of tools. It's a better, you know, allows better, more intelligent engagement. I think the other question about buggy code, certainly, trust me, it's a huge concern about ours, because someone, you know, decides they're going to write their own BGP stack and they screw it up. From attack perspective, it's the same, you know, it's a call. We're not going to say, you're not going to turn around and say, oh, you know, you're bad, see, you know, call me when it's fixed. You know, half the time, you know, you're going to be 2 hours into the fixing the call before you figure out, oh, yeah, they used some of that cool 1PK stuff, and, you know, they shot themselves in the foot. At some point, it's the same due diligence that we had, you know, when we started this whole thing about, you know, you need to have due diligence, you need to have tools, processes to understand what you're turning up. And to some degree, I don't think that's ever changed, right? You know, do you normally turn up configs on your network without ever checking them? No, you probably have them. You probably have someone else that checks them. It's going to be the same kind of stuff. You need to have some level of QA on whatever you turn up, whether it's stuff you write yourself or whether it's stuff you source off the net or from a, you know, that you paid for an ISV for.
So we beat all of that up quite a bit. Now, one of the things I noticed walking around in the Cisco section here of the World of Solutions is a Nexus 7004 on display. Who's interested in that product? Who has a marketplace for that product? Aside from Ron, yeah. And by Ron, we're talking about Ron Fuller, who actually we recorded about Nexus and several of the announcements going on, including the 7004. So, did any of you guys see that product and kind of get excited about it and have a home for it, or not really? Because we got the 7018, it's huge. The 7010, slightly less huge. You can fit it in a half rack. The 7009 is going to slot in behind your 6509. Now the 7004.
Fits in your purse.
Yeah. Just about. Fits in your purse, Omar.
She's got quite a bit of stuff in her bags usually.
Where would you guys position this? Or would you?
Tristan Rhodes, I think I was looking into the Nexus 5500 for small to medium sized data centers as a layer 3, but there's a limitation that there's no ISSU upgrade with the 5500 running layer 3, and so I'm like, well, I need some kind of a smaller router to do the layer 3 that has the high availability, so the 7004 can provide a lower entry point for small, medium data centers to do the layer 3. So that's what I think.
Yeah, that's the slot that I had it into. Now, I've already got a pair of 5596s with the layer 3 engine and its requisite limitations that are there that I'm going to be implementing. We'll see how it goes. And if it doesn't go so well, then next budget cycle, I am assuming the 7004 is reasonably priced. That's where I'm headed. It's a smaller footprint. I can deal with that. And I know it'll give me all the features. So Marco's being sarcastic. If it's a Cisco device, will it be reasonably priced? No one pays list, Marco. Just saying.
If you're paying list, I can help you out on that.
If you're paying list, I'll help you.
The World of Solutions has a lot of what I'm calling Cisco's frenemies, the partners that have value-add products. Did any of you guys walk around the floor, see a vendor or a product that you thought was pretty cool that you wanted to make a comment on? Or have you all just been in sessions hardcore the whole time?
We know Tom has it.
Nope. In fact, I may be missing one right now to do this.
That's fine. Nexus IS booth?
No. I mean, yes, the Nexus IS booth. No. I mean, that's the same stuff you see everywhere. No, Breaking Point. Have you guys checked out what they do?
Oh, yeah.
I've actually had the chance to use them before. What they came out with, and I don't know if everyone's talking about it. So Breaking Point does throughput and availability testing of your networks, but they also
beat your network to death and your applications to death to prove where they break. Breaking Point.
But even better, it'll give like literally you can get if you have a 7K, 5K, 2K infrastructure, you know how many milliseconds it take for each level to converge. Well, they got that for contact center and unified communications now. So you can torch your contact center, throw all this load through it, and then break everything in between and see, okay, if I take down one logger, how's that going to happen? If I do a network convergence event in the middle of my peak call flows, how's my contact center going to survive? It's actually really, really neat stuff. That's the Breaking Point booth.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
The Breaking Point boxes are expensive. I was at a shop that had Breaking Point in, and the point was to throw. You could cycle up the Breaking Point to test the full on like a web application. I need to know when this web application breaks because it's not just bandwidth. It's not just you got to test your server's capacity. You got to test how many ports you can open up to an application at the same time. You got to test transactions and the limitation, different kind of transactions. And a Breaking Point box can do all that. So there's other competitors in that space. I think Ixia lives in that space. Spirent lives in that space.
I own one. They're not that expensive.
So I got one in our shop. They're not that expensive, 200K for good stuff.
They're not Spirent expensive.
Yeah. If you do full throughput, they get really expensive. But for functional testing,
yeah,
it's not so bad.
Yeah. All right. Other vendors that you guys, anybody wanted to make a comment on? All right. Then let's change gears for sessions. What was your best session that you sat in, and maybe who presented, and what was the topic?
Nobody came for the sessions. Everyone's looking at me blankly. What?
You asked two random, so we're all looking at
you. Okay.
Yeah, okay. Well, the question was too hard.
Well, then I will bring up the one session that I went to. I went.
It had to be.
This
the
is
best.
Not a session. You know exactly. That, right?
Yeah, this doesn't count. No, I went this morning to the CCIE. Prep course for people that want to do the CCDE and CCAR. So basically this room was filled with a whole bunch of CCIEs that were all really pissed about the CCAR. Well, some of them were still asleep or hungover, but the ones that weren't were challenging the architect development team. Why is the CCIE not a requirement for the CCAR? You know, they don't see the allure of having that architect piece in there. And so I'm wondering, you know, amongst the packet pushers community, you know, because we have a lot of CCIs that listen, but we also have a lot of people who are designers and architects and things like that. You know, do you think that having technical implementation skills are critical to be able to design and or plan a network? Because, you know, one of the things that I tweeted about it was, when Cisco looked at this, absent of some overlap, the architect fits into the plan and prepare part of the development model. The DE fits into the design part of the model. And then the IEs get to clean up after both of them. So, I mean, do you see that as being critical? Can you the way it was worded in the session was, do you need to know how to drive a car before you can build one?
So, to be honest, I don't know a whole lot about the specific topic. I was reading Tom's at Networking Nerds tweets as it was going through the session. And, you know, as a guy who's been doing internet working, voice data for 15 years, all the best designers I know are guys who work their way up in the field and we're plugging stuff into the wall because they have an idea of what's going down in the trenches. I mean, how many people do we know who know CEOs and bigwigs who have no clue what's going on downstairs because they've never worked downstairs? There's no difference here. If you've never worked on that equipment, you don't have the perspective in order to be able to design it to know, you know what, we need to design around issues. We need to think about things a certain way. And everyone's seen a design that's come down, and that CCIE takes that design and sends it right back where it came from because that guy just hasn't done it. He's never been in the trenches. So I completely agree with your point.
Yeah.
Well, do you think that someone that's going to go for the CCAR should be all the way up through CCIE or just have some other kind of prerequisite that have to meet? Or is the CCIE where the prerequisite has to be?
You know, I don't know that necessarily the CCIE level is where it needs to be, but I think Tom makes the point that they need to have some kind of technical knowledge, and we're not talking about the CCNA on the bottom, but they got to have something to get them there. Is the CCIE what it is? Maybe not. Maybe there's a prerequisite exam that covers it. Who knows? But I don't think the story is totally told on the subject.
Shifting the mics to Brandon Carroll.
Yeah, mine's simple. I just think that when it comes to the certifications, I think it's time we stop drawing a pyramid and start drawing a tree, because that's how it is. It doesn't seem like there's any type of filtration to the top now. It's just all so spread out with requirements now that it's a mess.
Yeah, I think one of the things that I see coming from the wireless side of the fence, the CCIE wireless for me, going for that certification, there really isn't much of a way that I could have gone through that had I not had all the work experience, had gone through the CCNA wireless, CCNP wireless, to get a lot of that background knowledge. If you can just jump straight to the top, what does that mean? Does that devalue the certification? Does it make it seem like, okay, you can get that, but you've got no foundings, so you're book smart, you're not street smart? And I think some of the IEs, it really is, it's a lot of street smarts, because you need to know what actually happens when you do these configurations that you're reading about in the book. I hear it all the time on our responses to our podcast is, how can I become a CCIE wireless? Get experience. You can't do it in 6 months.
Well, and then here's the thing. Some other unnamed vendors have programs that let you jump straight to the top, provided you already have a top-level certification from another vendor, right?
He didn't say HP, but that's one of the people he was talking about.
Well, I call it what it is.
I think Marco's got a comment over here.
Well, I want to make my comments a little bit more broad when it comes to the design certifications. And CCIE has been, I would say, the most successful IT certification program in the world. It is turning 20 next year, and it is still possibly the most respected one. And one of the reasons why it is so successful, why it's so popular, is, of course, the integrity and the perceived difficulty of it. I'd say that CCI is not really that difficult. All you have to do is not fail the test. but there is another side of that coin, and that is that the success of the CCIE is in the fact that the CCIE is a prerequisite for a partner certification. Many of the CCIEs would have not been CCIEs had that restriction not be in place, that if a company wants to be a silver partner or a gold partner, it needs to have a certain number of CCIEs. That prerequisite, that requirement, does not exist for any expert-level design certifications, but basically the only one that exists, which is the CCDE. Granted, that program is relatively young, but those of us who have been in this industry a little bit longer remember that there are 4 CCIE design certified people in the world, or there have been. So there has been an attempt to create a design expert earlier. Now, these days we have a CCDE, but it's not a prerequisite, and the whole thing is very, very subjective, and I don't know how many of you actually have gone through the test. I have, and I believe that we have some who may be CCDEs right now, but they don't know yet because they're waiting for their results. The whole subjectiveness of the program that is tested through an interactive written test is not really a good thing. And that is a prerequisite for architect, which is not really a prerequisite for anything. So how many of architects are there? That's my question. And on a perceived integrity of the exam, how many of them have actually passed the test? And how many of them were grandfathered in? That is my major, thank you. That is my major, major complaint that I have about the architect program. Not to mention that it actually provides a perceived devaluation for the most successful certification program in the world, for the CCIEs. CCIEs, who used to be the top and the creme de la creme of the networking, are now said, yeah, you're actually 2 steps down. You're not even a prerequisite to become an architect.
So that was a long way to say you actually do, you think the CCA definitely should be part of it.
I like making my points long. That's what I do.
but the CERT lounge here still has a CCIE entrance. I mean, that's what it says, right?
But it was a mile long.
Architect, you could have gone on the non-CCIE entrance and be there in 30 seconds as opposed to 3 hours because the line was 2 miles long.
Wow, that was rough. So, what other sessions did anyone go to, dare I ask? let's go to Chris Church.
No, I was just going to say, the cloud services router session, I mean, that was really kind of a stealth session, I guess. It was kind of snuck in there, and I didn't really realize the magnitude of what they were talking about in there until I sat through it. You know, it's really a pretty fantastic product, and there's a lot of opportunity for change and realignment there with that product. And then the other one I sat in on today was performance routing seminar, which I thought was fantastic.
Colin, you got a session comment?
Well, it's one that I'm actually looking forward to going to in 45 minutes. And it's something which it was on the slides, and I don't think people paid enough attention to. It's a building scalable OpenStack clouds at noon today. There's a, you know, it's there's a lot of things that I saw on the slides about, you know, 1PK, about 1000V on multiple hypervisor. And, you know, and a lot of my web service provider clients are really talking to me about OpenStack and really driving my business to include that in their offerings. And I got to know Cisco's going there too, right? So I'm actually the thing I'm most excited about this week, besides Advanced and Certified Architectures, which is always a great class, is actually the OpenStack talk at noon.
I know I'm with a whole ton of really big packet pushers and routing switching guys, and that's what I used to do. But on the UCS side of the house, if you're looking at any UCS sessions, all the ones that were done by Steve McCreary were absolutely amazing. He will not put you to sleep at all. The guy's hilarious. So to be honest, if you have a chance to get into any one of his sessions, although a comment to Cisco on the sessions, they ran the advanced and expert sessions on Monday, and they ran some of the basic ones on Wednesday. So they're a little backwards on the timing, but I picked up more on that product in the last couple days going to his sessions than anybody else's. So his are really interesting. So if you're looking for some UCS stuff, especially the UCS The deep dive sessions, he's really great.
And remember, you guys, everybody can go to the Cisco Live 365 after this has been published to be able to get some of those slides.
Oh, yeah, which myself and my team is going to be doing as well, because, I mean, I couldn't get to all those sessions either. I mean, we all want to jump into a session that has nothing to do with what we do, just to sort of have some fun, right? So 365 will be the place to be for that.
They had a long list of videos that they were planning to sessions they were planning to record, so a lot of them will have videos and the slides.
Yeah, video and slides. I didn't get to go to any sessions because we were recording the whole time. But yeah, I'm hoping to catch some stuff on video as well. So just to close it off, why don't we just open up the floor? Is there anything, any other comments anybody wanted to make about the show, about Cisco, your experience here, other technical stuff you want to open up? We'll open it up.
You know, because I haven't actually talked enough yet during the podcast. I actually want to say thank you to the Cisco Live social media team for taking the time and the effort this year to make social media important. Because when you look at a lot of the other conferences like EMC World or VMworld, they are really hooked into social media. And for a long time, I felt like Cisco Live really wasn't. I mean, like I told Colin last year, we camped out in front of the registration desk because it was the only place that we could really find to meet up. And then this year, Cisco stepped up and they gave us the lounge that we're recording in right now, along with some other places, some satellite lounges for meeting up before keynotes and things like that. And I just want to see that kind of dedication to social media continue. You know, the ability to bring the packet pushers in, to bring the NSA show in, to have, you know, all of these people show up at a spur of a moment to record a podcast for everyone out there to consume is showing dedication. And I don't want that to die on the vine. I want that to continue to be so important.
Yeah, I completely agree. The social media aspect, Tom, you've mentioned this to me a few times throughout this week. The social media aspect of what is happening, that's what really makes this event a good event. We might be from competing VARs, but at the end of the day, if we don't make the solution work, it's not going to work for any of us. We all need to work together, and this brings all of us together into an environment where we can talk about some of the issues we've had, talk about the experiences we had, and it doesn't matter. It's all a bunch of friends here, and that's exactly what I think everyone sitting here is. We're a big group of friends. We started last year. Yeah. We're growing in numbers, and it adds so much value to these conferences.
That's actually a really good place to stop, I would say. You agree?
Yeah, I would agree.
Everybody agree? All right. You know what? Just for selfish purposes for the pack pushers, I would love it if I could get this whole crowd to say too much networking would never be enough together. Let me lead you into it.
Actually, get right in the middle, and then we'll...
On three. One, two, three.
Too much networking would never be enough.
Okay, we can take a break here for just a moment. Other topics that you guys want to talk about that are interesting?
I'm still mad about solving the application.
Hot topic. Why is the EMC World Bloggers Lounge perfect?
Oh, don't.
And the Cisco Live Bloggers Lounge.
Someone went to IKEA.
So Colin,
when you consider that the Cisco Live 2011 Bloggers Lounge was a table with four crappy chairs outside the registration desk last year, this is an upgrade.
This is an upgrade.
Would you like to look? Hey, look at the vector.
I'm at
Petco Park last night. Hey, figure out where you want us to put our budget.
If NexusIS would like to sponsor the 2013 Bloggers Lounge.
I'll step up to that. This 2013 Orlando NexusIS. Absolutely. We'd love to sponsor drinks, coffee, donuts, Mountain Dew. Bacon.
We will make this happen.
Bacon.
Wow.
Bacon waffles.
Make us the space, please.
You'll be happy to know next week I have to have a call about.
what the next step in the R vector looks like.
We'll even call it the Nexus Corner instead of Tom's Corner.
Which is impressive because it's round.
With the lounge, customer appreciation party.
That was great.
That's where we spent all the money.
Yeah. Tom's Corner, sponsored by Nexus. Yeah, there you go.
Does this mean I have to get a Nexus tattoo?
Nexus Engineering Mafia tramp stamp.
Dude, that's a belt, not a tramp stamp.
It's a handlebar.
I really wish I was recording on that one.
I'm recording, but none of this is going to make the cut, I don't think.
Thank God the mics are off.
You need the outtake.
Oh, no, it's on.
Mine was off, but his was on.
Oh man! When your podcast needs outtakes, you're doing something really wrong.
One of these days, we need to just clip all the things that don't make it into podcast, the beginning and the end, and just make a Packet Pushers blooper show. Yeah. It'll be a week long.
It is true. It is. You get so much content from just the blooper reel of trying to get going,
or the things that we say that we go, we can't publish that.
Just ask Jen for my podcast.
Sex furniture.
Although now that I think about it, some of the things that have made the Packet Pushers podcast is,
I'm not allowed to repeat Greg's famous one.
Not in mixed company.